This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're talking all about truth, survival, and loss. And I list three themes there because I haven't, as of recording this, yet decided which one we're going with as the main episode title. This is a conversation with a lot of themes running through it and really kind of harkens back to the storytelling roots of this podcast. It is an eye-opening story. He is so captivating in the way that he can go there and retell it when, you know, I'm interviewing him around a book launch. He's had this conversation many times and I really appreciate him revisiting it and being so open with me. I also want to address, it's good to be back in the recording seat. I've just recorded another episode around grief in young people that you'll find, you know, can relate quite strongly to this episode. So I plan to put that one out next. Is there some link to me having had a family funeral recently that pushed back some of my recordings? Who's to say? Because I go by a lot of the pictures that I get in. Maybe these ones stood out because of where I was at, but I'm in a good place. I don't want any of you to worry about me, and I'm delighted to be back behind the mic. So welcome back. Enjoy the episode. But first, I think I even missed saying that. If you'll indulge me for a second. So when we started off the podcast, I said that phrase in a few episodes. I said the but first. It just was the kind of transition to the ad break that came naturally to me. And then a few weeks in, I didn't say it. And then my producer was like, you didn't say the thing, the but first, that's part of the structure now. That's one of your sayings. And I didn't even realize I'd been saying it every week. So so now I'm obligated to say it all the time. It's good to be back. All right, on with the ads. Who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
I was born and raised in a small town called Hammond, Louisiana. Very tight-knit community. I don't know the population, but it's a very quaint town. And, you know, in all transparency, you have a railroad track that runs right in the center. And some people refer to it when they're asking, like, what part of town do you live in? Like, do you live across the tracks or not? You know, so just being from that area, you kind of get used to the lingo of the different pockets of neighborhoods. And, you know, where I was raised, it was 100% African-American neighborhood. You know, it wasn't the best of neighborhoods, to be honest. A lot of drugs, crime, not so much back then. Now I stay in tune with the community now, and it's like crime, you know, killings, murders all over the place. But back then it was, a murder was like few and far between. But it was, you know, it was a community where a lot of just not so good things occurred. You know, like I say, the drugs was high, and myself went to a Catholic school. You know, my parents sent me to a Catholic school. And I think after my mother passed when I was six, that's when I forget what grade, basically the timeline, but I do remember the bus for the school that I attended did not come in our neighborhood. So my dad had to pick me up from school every day and drop me off because, you know, for that private school in Hammond, that bus didn't make that route within our neighborhood. And I assume because not too many people from the neighborhood went to a Catholic school or private school. You know, actually, I was, if not the only Black kid at the school during my attendance. So, you know, different dynamic back then, but everybody, you know, everybody was friendly. They treated one another with respect. As an adult, I do tend to sometimes have the urge to go back home, but I don't stay long. I kind of go in, check in with people, family that I'm close to, then I'm out of there just because of so many traumatic memories I have surrounding that whole experience.
And I just want to pause on that actually with, you know, that contrast of going to a school, you know, outside of where you grew up and with a very different demographic. And at that young age, you know, what was your understanding of, you know, I live in a black area and this school is in a white area?
You know, as a kid, you really don't understand the depth of it, right? And what I mean, figuratively, you see, like, okay, well, nobody looks like me when I go to school. And when I came home, everyone looked like me, you know, but I really just couldn't put that in perspective and just really didn't focus on it. The way I was raised, we're all the same. We all bleed the same. We're all the same people. Even though historically, Southern Louisiana, you know, does have a pretty negative past in history as far as racism concerned, but I never really experienced any of that. Maybe a few times at school. I do recall one time they had a student that called me the N-word. I do remember that. And at that time, you know, I knew not to say that. And I knew if I was caught, it was a very, very bad thing. And all of my Caucasian friends, they came to my, you know, my support. And, you know, they basically just kind of rallied behind me and just, you know, just like telling the guy that's not right and basically report him to the teacher. But anyway, it was just different times back then from a diversity standpoint.
Yeah. And yet it's good to hear that you did have that backing. You know, when it came down to it, there was enough understanding, you know, among your peers.
Yes.
And you were sharing a bit about before you lost your mother. Would you mind sharing a bit about what happened to her?
So, yeah, you know, when I was six, I do recall vaguely that, you know, and that's why the title of my book is The Day My Mother Never Came Home, because that's what I remember. I remember my dad and I, we were at home one Saturday night and my mother went out somewhere and we were at home playing Nintendo. You know, Nintendo was popular back then. I was a big fan of video games as most kids, right? I think now their thing is Fortnite, which my four-year-old, I'm like, he asked me off and I'm like, I feel like I can't help you because I don't know anything about Fortnite. It was, you know, Nintendo. You know, you got two buttons and the trackpad. Pretty simple. But no, that night, my dad and I, we were playing the game and I recall us falling asleep, you know, and then the next day, mom wasn't there, you know, and I vaguely remember just as the hours went on, family came by the house. And it was just such an emotional time and scene that I recall, but back then I really didn't know what was actually happening. My energy was being mostly fed off of the energy I was surrounded by and the emotions that I was surrounded by, because as a six-year-old, it's very hard to communicate that his or her mother has been brutally murdered not too far away from where we lived, and found in a car with multiple stab wounds, you know, and I later learned the details of her murder as I began to get older and do research on my own.
And at that time, you're around family and this process of shock and mourning, obviously you were shielded from certain details of what happened. Was there a period of time when you didn't know that she'd been murdered and the family around you were holding that back?
Well, that all really came out as the years progressed and eventually, I say settled down, but things never really got settled within our house. But as things kind of took a life of its own and life continued to move forward, and as I got older, I did my own research to see what happened to them. Growing up, I knew that someone intentionally killed her, but I just didn't know the graphic details of what happened. And I'm saying this because not that one murder is best or worse than the other, you know, but it's one thing if, you know, someone is killed just by a gunshot wound. But it's another thing if it's like, if it sounds like someone intensely and she suffered, you know, in this case, my mother was stabbed over a dozen times. She was basically sexually assaulted. She had an umbrella in between her legs. Like, this was like extreme. Mm-hmm. And I became aware of this by doing my own research. And I'm not sure if you remember Back then, they had, I went to the local library where microfilm was a thing, which basically you pull the microfilm and you put it in this machine and you just kind of basically reminds me of a, like the film from a old camera.
Yeah.
I actually used to develop film as a job back in my early teenage days. But anyway, that's what it reminded me of. So you pull like a certain year, a certain time frame of a certain newspaper, whatever, and you just research. And that's how I came up on the article that was written by a local columnist in the area describing the murder of my mother.
And, you know, I want to come back to that because it's such a distinct way to find out what happened to someone that was so close to you, to read about it years later in someone else's words.
Right.
When you look back at the immediate time of her death, do you remember who it was that first had that conversation that she was gone?
It was my dad. I don't remember how it was actually communicated, but it's a video that later resurfaced this within the past 10 years that I never seen before when this case was basically reopened. It's a video of me as a 6-year-old being interviewed by one of the local detectives, probably like a month out from the actual murder. And one of the questions that she asked, just kind of leading up to the more challenging questions, was, who's currently at your house? Who currently lives there? And I recall my answer being that, you know, 6-year-old, I'm trying to process, right? I'm like, well, my dad, I had a golden Labrador named Duke. So I was like, my dad, I was like, Duke. And then when it got to my mother, I was kind of confused. I looked at my dad and you could tell that I was confused. And I was like, my dad interjected and was like, yeah, your mother's still there. She's there in spirit. Something to that effect. So I was confused. It was a month out, you know, it's a month out from the murder. I really didn't know if mom took a vacation. Who can say, right? But yeah, that was, to answer your question, I think my father was the first one that communicated that she was gone.
And so there's that delay of time when you're trying to wrap your head around it. And how do any of us wrap our head around losing a parent as an adult, let alone as a 6-year-old?
Excuse me. We have, my wife and I, we have a 4-year-old and a 2-month-old daughter. And a 4-year-old is a boy, and he is a mama's boy to heart. And if my wife goes to the store, goes to Target, he's just, where's mama? You know, when's my mama's going to come home? Some days, some mornings, she might have to leave early for work. He'll wake up frantic, like, where's mama? Jump out the bed, go looking for mama. And if mama's not there, he will get emotional. And, you know, I constantly look at him and I think about myself as a 6-year-old looking for mama and she never came back, which is totally different from looking for mama and you're able to call her, or, you know, like me being a dad and saying, hey, she's at work and she'll be home soon, versus mom's gone and she's gone forever. I can only imagine as a kid, you know, I don't remember those specific details, but just seeing my son and how he is, how attached he is to his mom, my wife, you know, I could only imagine the confusion that I was, you know, experiencing at that time.
And as you've reflected on this and of course written about it, have you been able to gain some clarity around what, you know, what elements have gone from your memory as a trauma response and what elements it is from how young you are and how vague those memories can be?
Yeah, you know, the whole writing process, it's been a healing process as well. And it served me the opportunity to kind of reevaluate my life and why I do certain things and why I act the way I act in certain situations. I always get criticized by my wife as, you know, as far as my not having enough emotions, or I'm not emotional enough. And, you know, it's not making an excuse, but my dad's a Marine. So I pretty much was raised to survive, not live. Mm-hmm. I didn't live the ordinary life as a child, you know, growing up. I played sports. I had fun, but it wasn't, because it was just him and I, you know, and he still had to be a provider for our household. And it's times I remember early on that I had to stay at home by myself while he goes to a business meeting or something like that, you know. And so I was basically grew up pretty quickly. But just writing, you know, I have identified things like I just mentioned, and just through my research and readings about trauma and the impact it can have on someone in an early age and just carry throughout their life. You know, I'm very self-accountable is what I learned, is that I don't, and I think it's a bad thing, you know. And what I mean by that is I rarely, if any, give anybody the due diligence to do anything for me or wait for someone to do it, you know, because I feel like I have had so much taken away from me in life. And I just feel like if I put it in someone else's hands, it could get screwed up, you know? So I think that's a trauma response, right?
Yeah. And it's one for different reasons to do with me growing up, I relate to very strongly, you know, and there is that line, you know, I think particularly with the way men are socialized, what is the difference between being right. strong in a way that you can be there for other people and you can be there for yourself, and strong shutting people out, thinking you have to do everything alone, you know, and that's right. actually not the stronger position than the first one, but that is how we can be
absolutely.
Encouraged.
It's definitely, and it can weigh you down, you know, as far as thinking that I have to do everything. If I don't do it, it's not going to get done. But that's definitely, to your point, that's definitely how I feel.
Yeah. And, you know, hearing you share there, that, you know, that really resonated with me around survival, you know, that there yes. was a lot of that for you growing up, and maybe some intersectionalities there that you've got your dad and his working background. So survival is literally a part of his job. And so he's bringing that kind of mentality, watching his back, watching your back. And then something like this happens. That was one yep. of those kind of rules of life, that the parent should die before the child.
Absolutely.
So then that confirms it is survival, because look what happened. And how do I trust people when this trust was broken? When one of the two people that were meant to be there for me isn't here anymore, and you're young and you don't know how to wrap your head around it.
That's a fact. And that's what I realized, you know, because I never really understood why I am the way I am until, you know, recently, just going through this whole process and just recapping and reliving my story and my life. And like a light bulb went off. I'm like, wow, like I've been through a lot as a kid. And then growing up through life, and then it kind of recycled, and now I'm going through trauma again, mm-hmm. you know. And like I say, I'm self-accountable, and not saying that's a healthy thing, but
when you say self-accountable, there, like self-reliant, would that be another way of putting it?
Yes.
So that's the person, the one person you put things on is yourself, and there is that trauma and revisiting trauma. You can be re-traumatized. There's conditions like PTSD where it has to be handled very delicately, because you can potentially compound the trauma by revisiting it. You can build on it. It can make people a lot worse. It can increase the symptoms. And I'm really interested in what you shared there about the writing process and, you know, revisiting this and understanding who you are because of this. Because on one hand, there can be these aha moments where you're like, oh, actually, some things are beginning to make sense and I'm getting to know myself right. better. But then there must also be those times when you're like, I didn't want some of these realizations, and seeing how much right. goes back to this.
Yeah. And things just kind of unfolded and took a life of its own. You know, that what my initial goal, when I said I'm going to write a memoir about my life, my goal was not to, hey, I'm writing this book to just kind of
stand myself better.
It wasn't a goal. Mm-hmm. The goal was to share my story that has been just bottled up for so many years. And being that the most recent events happened, I was like, well, it's out now. So and me share my side to help people. And I feel that in today's time with social media, if you just open up Instagram, Facebook right now, you see someone, quote unquote, living their best life, right? It's like everybody's doing great things and everybody's happy. But these are the stories that you rarely hear, you know, but these are the real stories, the true stories that can essentially help someone else that may be going through trauma. It may not be as bad, but they could be going through something, trying to figure a way out, or wondering if they can make it through this, they can make it past this. And someone that could simply pick up my book and just read about my story could basically draw that line and be like, man, if he made it through that, I definitely have a chance.
Yeah. And there's something to be said, even in cases like this, that as much as we don't want it to be the truth, murder is something that happens. And when you are going through that, even just knowing you're not the only one, that might be the only thing that you can latch onto.
Absolutely. Because growing up, you know, I always felt that around families and friends, I felt like I was always being stared at. Because again, where I'm from, it's a small community. Everybody knows everyone. Mm-hmm. You know, my family, I come from a large family, very well-known family. So that added, you know, more emphasis and attention, if you will, on me and just my family. So it's like going to family functions, everybody shows up. It's mom, it's dad, it's my cousins. So everyone had that complete family except for me. And I always felt like the oddball, you know, and I always shielded that. I was like, you know, and it was just my dad and I. You know, even outside of family, just going to school or going to play my friend's house, you know, I see that complete family and how they interact. But it was different when I got home from wherever I would fit in at the time.
Yeah, it's true. And there's that part of feeling different and also being made to feel different. The actions of others, the stigma that can exist around topics people don't know how to talk about and address. I have friends that lost a parent young and lived in a small town, and they can tell me of times they'd walk down the street and someone that knows them would cross the road because they don't know what to say.
Mm-hmm.
And how isolating these experiences are.
Hey.
You know, when in fact, you know, I tell me if you agree, it's not that you're asking anyone to have the perfect thing to say. You just want people to show up. You just want a bit of normalcy in a time when it feels like
that's it,
the bottom's gone out of your world.
I agree. And you know, when I share my story, you know, with, like, for example, you know, I work in corporate America around a bunch of smart people, professionals, and I had to build up the courage. And that's another thing I just want to address as far as where I'm currently at in my life, writing this book and putting it out there. And it took a lot of courage because, you know, I was afraid of being judged too. You know, people judge people for several different reasons. And, you know, just being in that professional environment and sharing such a story like this, you know, you can easily get judged easily. But thankfully, it had the opposite effect. You know, people were just kind of shocked. It was like, wow, you're dealing with this. You dealt with this. Like, I had no idea. Thanks for sharing your story. And it offered a lot of encouragement for me as well. I was like, well, I guess I did a good thing. But it was one of those things, you know, it took a lot of back and forth. I'm like, should I do this? Should I not? You know, and I just obviously went with the go ahead to say, you know what? Let's roll.
Well, I'm glad that you did, because there's so many stories like yours where people, whatever it is they've been through, we don't assume what people have going on in their lives. And particularly when you're raised a certain way, that you don't share that you don't talk about particular topics, that you keep your head down, you work, you provide, you survive. People won't know, but there is something deeply human about the ways in which we all struggle, the ways in which we all go through things that people would never guess, they would never assume.
They can never assume or guess. And when I shared, one thing I forgot to mention, I don't share the story for sympathy or for people to feel sorry for me, because that's not the goal here. And to your point, that's what I've been doing my entire life, just keeping my head down, staying focused, and just finding the next place to land and to reach my goal. Most of my motivation came from what I just explained earlier about being in environments where I felt like I was an oddball. I felt like I wasn't normal. I felt like my family wasn't normal. A lot of my motivation came from that. I said, one day I'm going to be normal. I'm going to have that wife, that family. And that was my motivation to, you know, keep going.
I do relate to that. I relate to that a lot, you know, and I've had many conversations where people come back to that point of wanting to find less normalcy in their life. You know, I just want to be average in a way. I just want to fit in. I just want to go under the radar.
Yep.
It's also based on a fallacy, this idea that there is a normal, you know, because there are parts of, you know, there are parts of even a story like yours that you can say, well, a single parent household, that's not unusual. A kid growing up in one area and going to school in another, that's a load of people's stories. You know, there's all these parts of it where there is the opportunity to relate and connect, but it comes with the conversation. It comes with communicating about our lives, being honest, being open. And that's the tough part. That's the bit we're not taught. And, you know, it is stories like yours that, well, if Reggie can share this, if he can talk about this, then we can all do with talking a bit more. You know, people want to connect to what's really happening in their community, to people around them. I want to circle back to that experience of reading about what happened to your mom, somebody else's words, years later.
So, yeah, it was one of those experiences that I felt like, I don't want to refer to it as an out-of-body experience, but I just felt like what I was reading didn't have anything to do with me or my family or my mother. I felt like I was reading something that I just kind of was numb until I just took a step and I reread it. I read it over and over again. And, you know, I got emotional at times because I'm like, this is my mother, which was so hard to believe, you know, because of the way she was taken and reading about it. It's just hard to, you know, make sense out of it. Still to this day, I look at it, I'm like, I still can't believe that. I feel like this is a part of my life that was never lived, if that makes sense. But I actually lived through this. That's how far I have came. I feel like it's not related to me, but it's just how much I progress in life. And now I'm at a point, it's like I have to address new challenges with another close family member. And it's like a revolving door.
And that is part of the, you know, the trauma response that can come up right there, that we have these moments that become like suspended in time. You know, they're like disconnected parts of our story. And, you know, that is exacerbated if you're reading these things that happened to you in a way, but you never knew until that point. You know, then it becomes suspended in the traumatic memory, and trying to put those pieces back together and find out the fuck they fit in my life, to be real with
it. It's true.
And, you know, you said that people do die all the time. It's true. But our mothers don't die all the time. Our dads, our grandparents, you know.
Exactly. Right.
It's always in proximity to you, you know. So
yes,
there is something so distinct about this experience, about murder, about the things that happened to her. But there's also something so distinct about that proximity.
Yes.
We can't say whether it's better or worse. You know, that's their experience. The impact, the familiarity, not a competition.
Right. It's not. Definitely not a competition, because trauma affects people differently.
Mm-hmm. And getting, you know, closer in the timeline to now, for a long time, the case was closed. Is that right?
Yes, for over 30 years. And I was at a point in my life, my dad was at a point in our lives, that we just got to, you know, just rebuild and just continue to live life. And I wasn't on I didn't have that part of my agenda as far as seeking out who actually committed murder and why. Again, it happened when I was six. I just kind of went through life facing those challenges and just try to normalize myself, you know, as much as possible. That makes sense.
And at that point, how was the case left originally? You know, was it closed that we don't have any leads to follow?
Yeah. It was, you know, they did a heavy and very thorough investigation back when it initially happened. And they had suspect, well, they had a couple of suspects. You know, they always suspect the spouse, and they basically cased the area, but nothing came from that during that time. So the case was officially closed and was deemed as a cold case. A few years ago, they changed dramatically, but about, let's see, we're in 2024. When I first moved to Texas, you know, after about a year, or maybe within that first year, after a day at work, I get a knock at the door. And it was a Texas Ranger, which is the state trooper of Texas. That's what they call them, Texas Ranger. So the gentleman showed up in a cowboy hat and a badge. And the first thing came to mind was, what did I do or what didn't I do?
Mm-hmm.
I thought I was in trouble. I was kind of freaked out. No one wants to see law enforcement at their house at 5:30 in the evening.
No.
And so... So anyway, that happened. He introduced himself, very nice guy. And I invited him in, and he basically said, look, I just want to talk to you about your mother's murder and ask you a few questions and ask, would you be willing to come down to the station within the next week or so for a more formalized interview? And I was like, yeah, I guess, why not? You know, and I had my questions of why is it coming up? And the answer was they got some new leads or some new evidence or something to that standpoint. I agreed to interview. One thing I didn't agree that they wanted to do was a hypnosis interview. They wanted to hypnotize me. And I was like, I'm not down with that. I don't really believe in that stuff. I always have a fear that if I go into a place and I might not come out. So I didn't agree to that. I just agreed to a formal, you know, sit down interview, basically recapping with what I remember as a six-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
Fast forward, I think that was conducted in like 2011. Fast forward, I hadn't heard anything until a few years, maybe 7 years after that. A few years ago from now, I get a call stating that my father was indicted for the murder of my mother. Again, I was working. It was toward the end of the day. But yeah, I got that call. It was basically a courtesy call is how they referenced it.
Mm-hmm.
Just a courtesy call, and that your dad has been indicted for second degree murder and conspiracy of your mother. So here we go again, right? It's like, life is good, you know, everything's going the way it should be. And I get that call and life just stops. Time pauses and I'm like, okay, here we go again.
Yeah, well, this is it. It's so serious. And yet there must be something ridiculous for you where you're like, seriously? I've had a long day and they're calling this a courtesy call? Like, I wanted to hear this.
Exactly. I'm like, wow. So let's digest this. So yeah, that happened. And you can only imagine what the thoughts coming through my mind at that point. You know, I'm like, I'm thinking automatically, I'm like, they got this wrong. This is a mistake. Like, my dad... It's 30 plus years later.
Yeah.
30 plus years later. And you're talking about the guy who raised me, killed my mother, the way that she was killed.
Yeah.
Can't make sense to me.
How can both things be true?
So that left me holding a bag again. And like you mentioned earlier, like a trauma response is can't trust people.
Mm-hmm.
Here I go again. As an adult, having to face trauma once again on the second part of my life.
And may I ask what the outcome was?
So the case was, you know, when he was initially indicted, he was held on a $250,000 bond, which the bond, the way that works is, obviously, if they set a bond that high, the intention is for you not to get out, mm-hmm. obviously. But if you go through a bail bondsman, you have to pay 10% of the amount. So I was a, you know, after about close to a year. This was right on the brink of COVID, mind you. So my thought was, okay, my dad was in jail. He was in jail for almost a year. COVID was really bad. I saw, you know, you read it in the news, and it was already bad externally, but in prison systems and jails, it was like really, really bad.
Yeah.
So my thought was, you know, my dad, he's up in age, and I was like, I can always work and make more money, but if something happens to my dad, I can't get my dad back. So I was able to move some things around financially with the support of my wife, and we were able to bond him out of jail. And his trial was set, I think, I'll forget what year exactly, but it kept getting delayed because of COVID, because the court systems weren't having court, you know, because COVID was at its peak. So it kept getting delayed, which at this point, I look back and like, that was a blessing in disguise, you know, because it allowed me to spend more time with my dad. He actually visited, he had to get approval to visit because he had an ankle monitor on throughout this time. He got approval from the local judge to visit Texas. So he came out, spent some time with me and my family. Fast forward, the trial finally had the green light. And November of 2022 is a week-long trial, and he was found guilty. That was a verdict. He was found guilty of second-degree murder, and now he's now serving life in prison.
And do you believe he was guilty?
You know, guilty of maybe some things. And what I mean by that is it was no smoking gun. You know, it was no one to say, hey, I saw him do this or that, except for a co-defendant who they offered a deal for. Because at the time my dad was indicted, it was also a co-defendant indicted as well. And how they tracked him down was from a cigarette butt that was found outside of the car at the crime scene when she was initially discovered. And back then in the 80s, they didn't have any DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So they later retested things, and he obviously was in the system, the coded system, the DNA profile, and it came back with a match. I'm still at a loss for words as far as thinking that my dad's that a monster that would commit such a heinous crime like that to his wife, my mother. It is a lot of things that came out in trial that I wasn't aware of from a discovery standpoint that does not look good. You know, it had me, you know, play devil's advocate. I'm like, this doesn't look good. This looks suspicious. I'm still at a crossroads as far as, you know, believing that he actually committed the crime. You know, I talked to law enforcement, got their feedback. And one of the things they shared with me, because one of my questions were, I had two key questions, okay? Why now? We're talking 30 plus years later.
Mm-hmm.
Why now? You know, my dad ran for mayor of Hammond. You know, he didn't win, but that's when you bring up dirt on people if you're running for political office. You know, my dad was big in politics, huge politician, worked on several local campaigns from city councilmen to judges, et cetera. And none of this ever came about. So that was my question. Why now? And then I wanted to know, okay, where did it happen? Where was she killed? You know, I was exposed to the crime scene video and trial, which was very graphic and very, very challenging to look at, if you could imagine. But she wasn't killed in the car. And just me just trying to get as much closure as possible. Excuse me, that was one of the key questions I had. And raising that question to local law enforcement, one of the gentlemen told me that we believe she was killed in the house. And my follow-up question was, where was I at? Because I remember playing Nintendo. And they was like, you probably was in the other room. And I'm like, no way. Like, it's no way. You know, yeah, very small house, two bedrooms. It's like literally you walk through the front door, it's the living room. And then it had another room called the TV room. On the right side of that was the kitchen. A few feet from that was the bathroom, then two bedrooms. Very small house, maybe 900 square feet, maybe. And I'm thinking like, I'm still a loss for words, you know, but to your question, I'm just at a crossroads as far as believing that he literally stabbed her multiple times. Like, she was brutally beat in the face, in the head, you know, severe trauma to those parts of the body. I just can't imagine that my father, the guy that raised me, would do something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And these are questions we may never know. With all the flaws in the criminal justice system, it is difficult to ever get a definitive answer. You know, the idea of proving guilty beyond reasonable doubt, even in the wording.
Exactly.
It is not absolutely 100% yes or absolutely 100% no. It is how much doubt there is. That's doubt you're always going to carry.
Absolutely.
And I don't know if there's maybe some solace with hearing that someone else might have been involved, and you wonder, was it that person? Did each of them do different things? And at a certain point, you wonder if it's helpful to you to even know, because he was still your dad and you still had those memories with him.
Exactly.
You know, you still had those good times too. And so how do you wrap your head around that?
It's tough.
Yeah. And so I really appreciate you sharing. I know it's not easy. And so, yeah, thank you for your patience with me and answering my questions today. And, you know, the book, I'll be fascinated to read it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And if people want to go find it, where would they go?
Well, obviously, one of the key outlets is Amazon. So it will be available on Amazon. Also, BarnesandNoble.com. It'll be available as well. And lastly, on my website, rlreed.com, it'll be available for pre-order through the website starting April 8th. But the official launch date is May 21st. Pre-order a signed copy from me through the website beginning April 8th, and that's rlreed.com.
Thank you. And so we'll wrap up there, and we do a little bit behind a paywall where we'll reflect on the conversation. But for now, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.